This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
I am Chief of Hematology Oncology at San Francisco General Hospital. At the beginning of my training, my fellowship here at UCSF to be an oncologist, suddenly AIDS came out of the blue and we didn't know what it was or what to do about it. And I became very much involved in treatment of patients with HIV. We didn't even know it was HIV then, but AIDS. And at the beginning was very much a champion of alternative therapies. And what I want to do now is integrative oncology, working with people living with and beyond cancer and helping them to integrate many of the modalities that I learned about in my fellowship into their conventional care. So what do I mean? What is integrative oncology? Integrative oncology provides relationship-centered care. It's not about, you know, a supplement or changing your diet. It's about having a relationship with the person. Now, that doesn't mean that I don't have a relationship with my patients at San Francisco General. In fact, I've used and brought over many of the techniques that I use at the Osher Center to San Francisco General. The way I start my consultation at the Osher Center is by saying to the patient, tell me your story. Very important. How long does a physician usually wait listening to a patient before they interrupt? Does anybody know? 18 seconds is the answer. So I listen. You know, if they go on for too long, I say, hey, do you want to hear anything from me? But, you know, sometimes patients say, what story or which story or sometimes they hand me a sheath of paper with laboratory reports, pathology, and x-rays, and I say, no, that's not your story. And oftentimes the spouse starts telling me the story. All of these tell me something. And I think that's what we're really trying to do. This is from The Mindful Therapist, published a few years back. Research suggests that our presence as medical or mental health clinicians, the way we bring ourselves fully into connection with those for whom we care, is one of the most crucial factors supporting how people heal, how they respond to our therapeutic efforts. So I think allowing people to tell the story is quite important. The other thing we do, as I said, is we integrate conventional and complementary methods of treatment and prevention, aiming to activate the body's innate healing response using natural, less invasive interventions whenever possible. Integrative oncology engages the mind, body, spirit, and the patient's community. And it also encourages providers to model healthy lifestyles for their patients. I know it's against the OSHA regulations, but my clinics are in the morning at San Francisco General and at the OSHA Center, and I'm always drinking green tea because that's important. And I drink my green tea in the morning, and if I wasn't drinking it while I'm in patient care activities, you know, I wouldn't have a chance to drink it. And now you'll notice I'm not drinking a canned beverage, soft drink. You know, I'm drinking carrot, beet, celery. We'll talk about that a little later. So I think it's important for us as providers, and I'm ashamed at some of my oncology colleagues when I watch them eat. You know, in the days when pharmaceutical companies used to take us to dinner, sometimes my colleagues would have a little hissy fit when they didn't get filet mignon. Now, I don't think oncologists should eat beef. I don't think anybody should eat beef, but especially oncologists. So we focus attention on lifestyle choices for prevention and maintenance of health and maintain that healing is always possible, even when curing is not. And that's very important when you're dealing with patients living with malignant disease. So where does CAM, or complementary alternative medicine, fit into this whole concept of integrative medicine that I'm trying to describe to you? I think I do use these tools in my management and work with my patients. The five categories of complementary medicine that the National Center recognizes are mind-body medicine, which includes mindfulness, meditation, hypnosis, guided imagery, to some extent yoga perhaps. The manual therapies are massage therapy, chiropractic and osteopathy, energy therapies, Reiki, healing touch, pharmaceutical and pharmacological and biological therapies are sort of what I'm more involved in because it fits more my Western medical paradigm of something works best if you swallow it. You know, that's what we learn. So these are supplements, vitamins, and nutrition. And then the culturally based healing traditions at the bottom here really each incorporate these four modalities. So these would be traditional Chinese medicine, Ayurveda, the medicine of ancient India, naturopathy, homeopathy, and tribal medicine. So those are the tools that we have in the toolbox. Now, what about oncologists? What do they know about these complementary therapies? And this is why it's important to appreciate that integrative oncology, what I'm doing, is a bit of a specialty because, as you know, the explosion in our ability to treat cancer over the last few decades has really come with many, many new drugs that work on different pathways in abnormal cells. And you cannot, you know, it's difficult for me to practice as a general oncologist at San Francisco General, where I treat all cancers. My colleagues at the Cancer Center do breast, kidney, colon, liver. Everybody's got a different organ because there's so much to know about it and to be an expert. So you can't really expect oncologists who are not really interested in this to know that much about it. And we also know that patients with cancer are not willing to share information about their use of complementary therapies with their oncologist because they fear that their physician will at best be indifferent or worse, oppose their use. And again, this is because of the physician's emphasis on scientific evidence and evidence-based medicine. And again, anticipating this negative response. It's the NCAM had a campaign called Ask Tell, so that providers would ask their patients about their use of complementary therapies and encouraging, at the same time, patients to disclose to their providers their use of these agents. And it's important, as we'll see, because there are some potentials for interactions. Now, another interesting piece of information that I think I wanted to go over early in this conversation was what motivates patients to choose a particular complementary therapy. This is a small study of 34 men with prostate cancer in the United Kingdom. And they asked them, with regards to the particular therapies that they were using, what was the evidence that they found most personally meaningful? And the number one driver for what motivated patients to use a complementary intervention was personal stories of people that had been helped by that, or the long history and enduring popularity of that treatment. Plausibility of mechanism of action was lower. Scientific evidence was sort of at the bottom. The flip side of what one would anticipate if you asked an oncologist what they use in suggesting an intervention to their patient. So I think it's important for us to acknowledge these different standards of evidence that are used by patients and the oncologists. So integrative oncology, I think, has three potential useful areas. Number one, in reducing the risk of cancer. One of my best friends is Robert Bazell, who just retired 2 weeks ago as the NBC News chief science correspondent. And Robert said, Donald, if you do anything as an oncologist, can you please try to get this concept of preventing cancer eradicated? Because he's right. You know, I see a lot of people said, I did everything right in my life to prevent cancer. Why did I get it? You cannot prevent cancer. You can reduce the risk. And I think it's easier to say. I'm actually on a committee at the National Cancer Institute. I work on an editorial board. And we talk about cancer prevention. And I asked the chief editor, can we just take this a little higher and see if we could ask the people at the NCI to get rid of cancer prevention? They have a whole institute or wing or program in cancer prevention. And there was a little email back and forth, and the response from the cancer prevention people was, Americans understand that toothpaste prevents cavities. If we said reduce the risk, it would be over the head of most of the public. So we're going to stick with cancer prevention. But I think it's an unfortunate term. So I'm going to try to talk about reducing the risk. And I think these complementary therapies can help reduce the risk. For cancer treatment itself, I think there's not a lot of good evidence that any of these interventions are really that useful in cancer treatment. And that's why it's important for me that I'm an oncologist, so I could integrate complementary therapies into conventional therapies, which I think are useful for cancer treatment. Symptom management and palliation, I think, are the area where complementary interventions really are the most useful and most effective. So with regards to integrative cancer risk reduction, again, lifestyle is really the key word. And we're going to talk more about this, but maintenance of a healthy body mass index, or height to weight ratio, regular aerobic and resistance exercise, and following dietary guidelines are really key. Complementary therapies may also be useful interventions in smoking cessation, and research has demonstrated that both hypnosis and acupuncture may help people stop smoking. Whether or not supplements can actually reduce the risk of cancer is very controversial, and we'll talk a little bit about that, but they can do other things like decrease inflammation and perhaps boost innate immunity. Now, even our sort of conventional oncology newspapers are starting to get wind of the fact that some people are being misguided, if you will, and looking for cures of cancer in this realm of alternative therapies. I think any evidence that alternative therapies or even complementary therapies are useful for treating cancer is far from compelling. So I see about 5% of the patients I see at the Osher Center are people who are refusing conventional cancer care and come to me hoping that I have an alternative to, as they say, cut, burn, and poison, surgery, radiation, and chemo. And I say, I'm sorry, I'm an oncologist for 30 years, and I'm very impressed with our ability to cure 14 million Americans of cancer with these conventional therapies. I turn around, I open the little drawer behind me, I say, I don't have anything magic in here. I think you need to be treated with conventional therapy, and I will work with you to try to integrate these other modalities to decrease some of the side effects that you may have. So that's where I think we really can do quite a bit in management, symptom, and palliative care, relieving or preventing side effects of both treatment and cancer itself, promoting relaxation, reducing stress, relieving pain, improving sleep, and enhancing the patient's quality of life. Immunity, I've mentioned a few times. Inflammation and immunity, I think, go hand in hand. We'll talk a little bit more about that. I think we can do things to help improve the patient's immune function so that that can also kick in the fight against cancer. And maybe, you know, maybe we're doing something to help prolong a disease-free state and perhaps even prolong survival. So when I see a patient at the Osher Center, I have a number of goals. The first really is to increase the patient's sense of control. If somebody told you tomorrow that you had cancer, you would feel that the rug had been pulled out from underneath you. Highly functioning people suddenly are at the mercy of a surgeon, radiation therapist, medical oncologist, chemotherapy nurse. Where's your control? What I like to do is give the patient a number of things that they themselves can do to contribute to their care. I mentioned inflammation. Let me just take a moment. Inflammation, if you cut yourself or if you have surgery, when you heal, it gets red, hot, tender, and swollen. Those are the four, rubor, dolor, we learned in medical school, four Latin words. I can only remember two of them at this age. But that's inflammation. It's part of normal healing. But when it goes on inside of our body without provocation, it leads to degenerative diseases of aging, such as dementia, heart disease, and cancer. And there's, I think, much that we can do to decrease inflammation in the body. And if you decrease that inflammation, which is mediated by the body's immune system, it frees up the immune system to focus on eliminating cancer, because our own T lymphocytes are there fighting to eradicate little tumors that may pop up in our body. And because the immune system is unencumbered and working well, it keeps us free of developing malignant diseases. Stress. When I ask patients to tell me their story, we had a nurse go through 150 charts of patients we had seen at the Osher Center. And she said, "Boy, Donald, your patients are really stressed." Well, she's just reading the notes, so it's me writing down the stress that the patient told me about. But many patients, when I say, "Tell me your story," try to build a case that stress may have been causative in the development of their cancer. I don't think stress in and of itself causes cancer, but what is stress? Stress is epinephrine or adrenaline, which kills lymphocytes, the building block cells of the immune system. And stress is cortisol, which is a steroid hormone, which is an immune suppressant. And studies now have been done in mice that suggest that stress increases the spread of cancer. For example, they took mice with breast cancer, and one group was stressed. That is, they were confined to a small space for 3 hours each day. And the other group ran free. And at the end of their study, the stress mice, their primary breast cancer was the same in both groups, but the stress mice had increased size and number of metastases. Now they're finding out that beta blockers, which are sort of tone down our fight or flight system, people take them for blood pressure, may have some utility in prolonging survival in people with cancer. And I say, isn't that our American pharmaceutically dominated paradigm? The way to reduce stress is to take a beta blocker. No, reduce stress. And so we can talk about other ways to do that rather than take a pill. I think all of these things together increase the patient's sense of hope. Many patients leave the room after our first hour consultation saying, "Dr. Abrams, you're the first person that's given me any hope." I don't say you don't have cancer or you're not going to die, you know, but I give people a handful of things that they themselves can do to increase their sense of control. So what are some of those things? Number one, I was delighted that the CDC recently, last week or two, decided obesity was a disease. Hello, you know, it's taken a little bit of time, but controlling weight is very important. You think, well, cancer, you want those people to not lose weight because that means the cancer is getting ahead of the game. But in fact, you know, there are many obesity-associated malignancies, and I'll talk about that in just a second. So controlling weight by altering diet and increasing physical activity is something that I spend a lot of time discussing with patients. And then we talk about some supplements, again, for decreasing inflammation or increasing, enhancing immune activity. The link between the mind and the body is the breath. The word for breath in Hebrew is spirit, the same word. And you were all just breathing without thinking about it until I mentioned it, sort of the pink elephant in the room. Now you're thinking about your breathing, and now control it. You can control the rate and the depth. And so that fact that we do that consciously and unconsciously is the link between the mind and body and many so-called mind-body interventions, hypnosis, guided imagery, yoga. People do yoga. It's all about moving with your breath, tai chi, all of those things. And then you can also listen to guided imagery CD-ROMs, self-hypnosis. A friend of mine did a book on self-hypnosis, and he asked me to write a praise quote for it. And I said, it would be better as a book on tape, because every time I started reading, it said, "Now close your eyes." So anyway, connect with family and friends. Very rarely do I see a patient coming in by themselves to see me at the Osher Center. As I say, cancer does not affect just one person. It affects a big circle around that person. Engaging spirituality and religion. At the end of my history, before I examine the patient, I say, were you raised with any religious beliefs? Many people were. Currently, do you have any? Most people, not really, or they've altered them, especially here in San Francisco. Do you consider yourself spiritual? And that's a fun one to look, if there's a spouse, to see if the patient is telling the truth. Because, you know, the spouse sometimes goes, and the patient's going, yes. And then I ask three questions. What brings you joy? What are your hopes? And where does your strength come from? And, you know, sometimes, about 30% of the time, that one of those questions is going to bring tears to somebody. I always try to figure out if I can tell who or which question. But the point of it is that at the end of my whole consultation, I give patients back their joy, their hopes, and their strength, because they have them, even though they're facing this tremendous challenge of fighting cancer. So now let's talk about some of these things that I talk about when I'm with my patients. I've also lived with a macrobiotic chef for the past 19 years, and I was amazed because in medical school, we don't learn anything about nutrition, or at least we didn't when I went to Stanford many centuries or decades ago. Well, it was a century, too. Anyway, and when I took my fellowship training, I'd come home and say, you're right. Yeah, because, you know, there is something about nutrition that is very important, and Hippocrates knew that back centuries ago when he said, let your food be your medicine and your medicine be your food. So proportion of cancer deaths that are caused by different avoidable cancers are these from estimates in the 80s and then at the end of the last century. And I think most Americans can identify that tobacco is a cause of about 30% of avoidable cancer deaths. And because dermatologists are so effective in their campaign, the vast majority of Americans can identify ionizing and ultraviolet light as a cause of a much smaller percentage of avoidable cancer deaths. Just about half are aware that nutrition, what we eat, what we don't eat, and our body weight is responsible, similarly for physical inactivity. So this is something that, again, preventable is not my word, but it's something we can reduce the risk. In this particular graph, the author is saying 35% of cancers are related to diet, and another 14 to 20% obesity. That might be, you know, a little much, but points out that, again, our genes are not responsible for so many cancers, and there is a lot of lifestyle and habits that are definitely responsible. So diet and cancer, probably, again, 30 to 35%. And the problem is our certainty about diet is much less than our certainty about tobacco use. Because tobacco use, you know, people do it for a certain, we can measure, they did it for 40 years, a pack a day. But diet, what are we talking about? And plus, when we read the newspaper, they always say it did this or it didn't do that, and there's conflicting data. And what is the diet? You know, is it what we ate? You know, is it what I just had outside in my carrot beet juice? Or is it what I ate when I was an adolescent? Or is it what our mothers ate, which would be even more frightening? But this is a mouse model which suggests that epigenetics, not the gene itself, but how the gene is expressed, are important and can be modulated by what we eat. This is the so-called a Judy mouse, where the LTR hypomethylated version is a yellow obese mouse with a high risk for developing diabetes, cancer, and a reduced lifespan. If the mothers, however, are supplemented with some minerals, vitamins, and the soy isoflavone genistein, their offspring are the hypermethylated gray thin mice that have a much lower risk of these diseases and a longer lifespan. So there is some possibility that it was our mother's cravings when we were in utero that are really dictating what we're going to get. But Despite that, we do have some guidelines. And the two guidelines that I like to cite are, number one, the American Cancer Society every 5 years updates their guidelines on nutrition, body habitus, physical activity, and cancer. And every 10 years, the American Institute for Cancer Research, World Cancer Research Fund, puts out a 700-page tome, which is the consensus volume of experts from all over the world, food, nutrition, physical activity, and the prevention, it says, but they mean reduction of risk of cancer, a global perspective. So I like the AICR guidelines, and their number one guideline says, be as lean as possible without becoming underweight. And the number two guideline, I think, is a corollary to that, is be physically active for at least 30 minutes every day. How many people in the room are physically active for at least 30 minutes every day? All right. That's pretty good. Okay, we can discuss that later. Well, so again, I am happy that the CDC has recognized obesity as a problem. I got tired of being medicine attending at San Francisco General and having my residents and interns and medical students tell me about a patient that I had not yet seen. Patient has diabetes, hypertension, high lipids, osteoarthritis, and sleep apnea. And I say, anything else? And they say, no. And I walk in the room and there's a 300-pound person lying in the bed. I said, the number one problem you left out. And this is a big problem in our country. I didn't put in the 25 slides here that shows you the transition of our country from being, this is obesity trends, body mass index greater than 30, and these are the percentage of each state that has their population greater than 30. And you can see now Colorado was the last state to have less than 20% of their adults obese. Now in the United States, 33% of us are obese. That is a BMI greater than 30. And another 30% are overweight, a BMI between 25 and 30. So it's really quite striking as you travel around the country, the differences that you see. And obesity is probably related to 14% of malignant diagnoses in men and about 20% of the malignant diagnoses in women. The American Institute for Cancer Research estimates that excesses of these seven cancers account for 105,000 preventable deaths each year in the United States. Breast cancer, because it's the largest cancer diagnosed in women, of 33,000 deaths a year are related to obesity. Although only 17% of breast cancer is obesity related, and that's usually postmenopausal estrogen receptor positive breast cancer. In contrast, 50% of uterine cancer is related to obesity, but because it's a much smaller number of patients, it's a smaller number of cases. And you can see the rest of these are malignancies in the gastrointestinal tract related to obesity. Well, how does obesity or body fat increase the risk of cancer? Body fat secretes chemicals that promote inflammation. And I've already mentioned a number of times that inflammation seems to be key in the development of malignant disease. Fat also produces estrogen. So women do all this to knock out their ovaries as producers of estrogen when they have breast cancer, but if they're remaining obese, they're producing estrogen. And that's not good for breast, endometrial, probably ovarian as well. Increase in body fat also impairs immunity. Some of that is from number one and number two above. And then probably becoming more important and more recognized as being important, too much body fat triggers insulin resistance. And this raises the levels of insulin and growth factors that promote cancer. So this is a study looking at physical activity in colon cancer, and talk about evidence. Now it's becoming quite elegant. The Women's Health Initiative cohort studied the relationship between body mass index, recreational activity, and survival in postmenopausal women with colorectal cancer, also very much related to obesity. There were 2,093 women developed colorectal cancer, and 1,300 were eligible in this analysis. And they were grouped into categories of their physical activity, 0 met hours per week being the lowest, and greater than 18 is equivalent to more than 3 hours a week of moderate activity. So in an analysis, women who had pre-diagnostic, before their diagnosis of colon cancer, physical activity levels highest or more metabolic hours a week compared with the sedentary group had a 1/3 reduction in death from colorectal cancer. That's pretty good. Almost 40% reduction in all-cause mortality. And the benefit was more prominent in women with normal body mass index. And again, the group that had intermediate physical activity had a greater than 20 reduction, but greater than 20% reduction, but that was not statistically significant. I can see I'm doing my slides too late at night lately. So 606 women were eligible for a post-diagnostic activity, and those who were the most physically active, again, had a 71% decrease in colorectal cancer mortality and a 60% decrease in all-cause mortality. BMI itself was not associated with mortality in either analysis. So really what this is saying is that physical activity is almost as effective as adjuvant chemotherapy in reducing the risk of mortality and disease progression, although that's not shown here. The next guideline is really the first that says anything about food. And I was at the meeting in 2007 in Bethesda when they sort of changed the order here of this recommendation. It used to go, this was the top bullet, and this was secondary. And so I thought that was a pretty big shift. And I went to the microphone, and I said, there are sugary drinks, and there are sugary drinks. You can drink a cola beverage. I can't say the name because I'm being filmed, God forbid. Or you can drink a fruit punch, which is probably glucose and high fructose corn syrup. Or you can squeeze 3 oranges in the morning. And the response from the podium was energetically, they're all the same. So I reviewed this with Robert Lustig, who's our pediatric endocrinologist on campus here, who's a big fighter of obesity in children and a big person who's trying to make America aware of the poison that is sugar. And Robert explained to me that when you eat an orange, the fiber slows down the absorption of sugar into the bloodstream. When you squeeze the sugar away from the fiber, it's like drinking a Coca-Cola. So why is that bad? When the body sees that load of sugar, it squirts out insulin and insulin-like growth factor, both of which promote inflammation and cause cancer cells to divide. So does it mean I don't squeeze 3 oranges in the morning? I just, when I bought my dinner tonight down the street, I bought 3 oranges. I do it maybe twice a week. And I told you I'd get back to my drink. So when I say sugar, it's okay to have sugar in the nutrition facts box when you buy a food that has packaging because that sugar fuels our brain. Where I don't want to see sugar is in the ingredients list. The ingredients list, carrots, beets, celery, lime juice. In the nutrition facts box, carbohydrates, 17 grams, dietary fiber, 1 gram, sugars, 12 grams. You can't only buy food that has 0 grams of sugar because you need to fuel your brain. So the point is, okay sugar in the nutrition facts box, not okay sugar as an added ingredient. And this is, I don't think this is just for people living with cancer. I think everybody should be cognizant of that, and we should really try to avoid sugar. Can we? I mean, the average American is now consuming over 100 pounds of sugar or caloric sweeteners a year. It would be interesting to see where this was only goes to 2008. We saw high fructose corn syrup coming up. It's gotten such a bad name now, I think it's probably on the down, whereas refined sugar, which seems to be the hero, is on the upswing. I love this. David Sarah von Shriver wrote the book Anti-Cancer, and he showed this in a lecture, and I can't stop sharing it with people because I think it's so great. It obviously was written before the time that we had zip codes in the United States, so this predates 1962. So those of us that were born before 62, our mothers were indoctrinated with, for a better start in life, start COLA earlier. How soon is too soon? Not soon enough. Laboratory tests over the last few years have proven that babies who start drinking soda during that early formative period have a much higher chance of gaining acceptance and, quote, fitting in during those awkward preteen and teen years. So do yourself a favor, do your child a favor. Start them on a strict regimen of sodas and other sugary carbonated beverages right now for a lifetime of guaranteed happiness. It's true. And so I think it's only fitting that The Economist here, when it shows how our society is progressing, demonstrates that it is that big slurp or big gulp or whatever you call it that may be contributing to the shape of things to come. We know this, again, because diabetics, insulin, they take insulin. Now evidence that insulin is a problem. Diabetics have increased rate of a number of different malignancies. And if you look at mortality in various cancers in diabetics compared to patients with the same cancer who are not diabetic, they have higher death rates. And the authors of this article said it's because of increased proliferation and metastases with too much insulin, too much sugar, and increased reactive oxygen species. So here's the data that endometrial cancer, the risk is of death in diabetics has increased about 80%, breast cancer 60%, colorectal cancer 33%. So significant increased death rates in diabetics. And what we know now is that this is the insulin-like growth factor 1 receptor, which binds to insulin, insulin-like growth factor 1 and insulin-like growth factor 2. And when it does that, it sets off a cascade within the cell that leads to increased synthesis of proteins that lead to increased proliferation of the cell or cell division of cancer cells and decreased apoptosis, which you may have learned from former lectures in this series, that's programmed cell death. So the cells don't die as programmed. All of this, again, leads to increased cancer cells and to the point where now drug companies are producing blockade of the insulin-like growth factor receptor as a treatment for various cancers. And it's felt that this is particularly important, again, in breast cancer. So this is a supplement that many of our patients in the hospitals and many of my cancer patients drink. Now, I just told you something about reading labels. So first ingredient is water. Second is corn maltodextrin. What does that sound like? Sugar. It's sugar made from corn. The third ingredient is sugar. The fourth ingredient is, I guess, fructooligosaccharides sound a little bit like they might also be. So cancer patients drinking this, if you have any friends or family who have cancer, don't give them a can of that, please. Not a good thing. Metformin, interestingly, is an oral diabetes drug that patients are taking that, believe it or not, is a natural product. It's active ingredient in the French lilac, and it's used for treating frequent urination in diabetes in herbal medicine. Epidemiologic studies show decreased cancer risk in patients taking metformin for their diabetes. And in the test tube, it inhibits prostate, ovarian, and breast cancer cells, selectively killing the precursor or cancer stem cells. So it's currently in cancer clinical trials. And this was from an online page. Diabetes pill from 1958 may be new cancer drug. So, you know, what do we know about how it works? It works directly on the tumor as well as indirectly on the host by lowering the insulin levels. In the liver, metformin inhibits transcription of key factors, genes that create glucose, and increases the uptake of glucose in skeletal muscles, leading to decreased levels of circulating glucose, increased sensitivity to insulin, and decreased insulin resistance-associated hyperinsulinemia. So again, it's insulin that's bad, and this is good. Please keep questions until the end. So, and again, this metformin probably also works at the level of cell signaling. Many of you may have remembered Watson of Watson and Crick, who discovered DNA, recently came out saying that antioxidants are bad for us because they might cause cancer. We can talk about that in a little bit. But he also, in the same article, said metformin may be a really useful adjunctive drug to use in patients with cancer. Now, I have a patient with pancreatic cancer, and I said, you know, it's metastatic. My best friend died of pancreatic cancer 1 year. Pancreatic is not a good cancer. And I said, you know, maybe we should think about metformin for you. So she asked her oncologist, and he said, there is not evidence to support that. I said, why don't you ask your primary care doctor? So she said, okay, will you call my primary care doctor? So I called her primary care doctor. I said, I think this patient warrants a trial of metformin. You know, she has metastatic pancreatic cancer, and there's some evidence, you know, that maybe there's a benefit. I said, I can send you articles. She said, don't send me anything. I have 3 kids at home. I don't have time to read articles. All my patients are on metformin. It's easy. It's cheap. It's the most prescribed drug that I use. I'll give it to her. So she did. Her disease progressed, but she's still coming to see me, so she's doing all right. About 6 months. Eat more of a variety of vegetables, fruits, whole grains, and legumes is the 4th guideline. And we don't do that in this country. Such a simple thing. CDC reports only 14% of adults eat the recommended number of servings of fruits and vegetables a day. A third eat 2 or more servings of fruit, and about a quarter eat 3 or more servings of vegetables. The states that do it best are in the Northeast, and the southern states where the obesity exists are the ones that don't really do it at all. Unfortunately, less than 10% of high school students are meeting that objective that was set in the year 2000 was to have 75% of Americans meet the fruit and 50% meet the vegetable guideline. Even the August magazine Science is recognizing the disease preventive effects of vegetables and fruits. So my recommendations to my patients, and again my friends, are to eat more phytoestrogens, plant estrogens, soy foods, and flaxseed. Cruciferous vegetables, you can never get enough cruciferous vegetables. Broccoli, cauliflower, and Brussels sprout come to mind, but there are also cruciferous roots and green leafies that are cruciferous. Cabbage, kale, arugula, bok choy, collard greens, all of these contain 2 things. One is called indole-3-carbinol, which is so potent at reducing the risk of cancer that we've thought of looking at it as chemotherapy. And the other is something called DIM, which changes estrogen from the type that drives estrogen receptor-positive tumors to the type that doesn't. Now, both DIM and indole-3-carbinol are available in capsules. And a lot of patients come to me saying, should I take these capsules? Or they're already taking them. Paracelsus was an alchemist who spanned alchemy and medicine in the Renaissance, who said there's poison in everything. The difference between a remedy and a poison is the dose. I think it's fine to eat broccoli. I eat broccoli and tofu and rice for breakfast. I eat cruciferous vegetables at least 3 times a day. I'm not going to take a broccoli supplement powder and sprinkle it on a smoothie. I'm not going to take indole-3-carbinol or DIM, because I don't know what that's going to do to me. I told you I drink green tea. People found that if they took green tea extract capsules on an empty stomach, it could lead to liver damage. Resveratrol, very popular, found in red grapes and red wine. 1 gram of resveratrol is the amount of resveratrol from 667 bottles of red wine. Is that something you want to take in one sitting? I'm not sure. I would wait. Season liberally with ginger, garlic, onions, and turmeric. Turmeric is a very, very potent anti-cancer spice and anti-inflammatory. I've already mentioned green tea, omega-3 fatty acids found in deep cold water fish, salmon, black cod, albacore tuna, herring, mackerel, and sardines. Actually, the same fish are pretty much the only food source of vitamin D, which, of course, we make from the sunshine. So just recently, sulforaphane, which is one of the constituents of these cruciferous vegetables, has been studied in prostate cancer. Cruciferous vegetables are strongly associated with a lower risk of prostate cancer. And in animal studies, suggested that sulforaphane inhibited histone deacetylase and suppressed androgen receptor signaling. There was a specific gene that contributes to our metabolism of sulforaphane. So this study took 20 men with prostate cancer whose PSA after treatment initially was going up, despite the fact that they had previous surgery or radiation, and they treated them with 20 micromolar of sulforaphane a day. 16 patients completed the 20 weeks. One patient had a significant PSA decline of greater than 50%. Seven had more moderate declines, and three had lower effects. The PSA doubling time, which is something we use to measure the aggressiveness of the disease, increased from 6 months to 9.4 months. So the author in an interview said, the compound we used is limited by not having several species toxicity, which means you give it to animals, monkeys, and dogs to find out how toxic it is, which will be necessary prior to dose escalation. Groups are working on developing a synthetic version with drug-like properties. There are also over-the-counter preparations, but I am not familiar with their quality control. Eat cruciferous vegetables. I mean, this is, again, our Western pharmaceutically dominated paradigm, making broccoli into a drug. There aren't preclinical several species toxicity studies. How toxic is broccoli? Anyway, soy and breast cancer. Very frequently, I am dealing with women who are afraid to take or eat soy if they have breast cancer, because soy can work, or the active ingredients in soy, the potent isoflavones, can work as selective estrogen receptor modifiers, and that's how tamoxifen works, which is something we use to treat women with estrogen receptor positive breast cancer. Well, Kaiser in Oakland did a large study called the LACE study, Life After Cancer Epidemiology, following about 2,000 women with breast cancer for an average of 6 years. And of those, 282 had breast cancer recur. And as part of their intake in the study, they were carefully asking them about their consumption of soy foods. So soy food intake at levels comparable to those consumed in an Asian population, which is one serving of soy food a day, seems to reduce the risk of recurrence in women who have been treated with tamoxifen. And in postmenopausal women, the risk was reduced 50%. And soy does not appear to negate the beneficial effects of tamoxifen. Although this is all very convincing, they said further confirmation is required. Again, this is where I told you, in medicine, confirmation means randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled trial. This half of the room eat tofu. For the next 15 years, this half eat placebo tofu. Some people think tofu already tastes like placebo. So, you know, you can't do those studies. Fortunately, a large study in Shanghai found exactly the same thing. So what do I mean by soy foods? So whole soy foods, soybeans, soy milk, tofu, tempeh, and miso. I don't mean soy cheese, soy turkey, and soy hot dogs, because those are just heavily processed foods. Turmeric. How many people take a turmeric supplement? Okay. How many people try to cook with turmeric? So the first I heard about turmeric was at our conventional cancer meeting, the American Society of Clinical Oncology. I hate that meeting. It's in Chicago in that huge convention center. You feel like you're in O'Hare Airport. Get from one place to another. It's 30 minutes. By the time you get there, you've missed the presentation. But that year, I think the 2006, because I think I was on the medical education committee, I had to go. Ohio State investigators have a mouse model of colon cancer where the mice are genetically programmed to develop colon cancer. And in their experiment, they fed these mice a turmeric-enriched diet. Not only did they not develop colon cancer, but they survived longer than the control group. So that was the first I heard about turmeric. But Bagwal Agarwal at MD Anderson in Houston really has done a lot of writing and a lot of studies, and comes up that turmeric is probably our most potent anti-cancer spice, with many different properties: antioxidant, we talk about, anti-inflammatory, protecting against cancer, against mutagenesis, just a lot of different things that turmeric does. And if you want to get fancy, these are the different pathways in cells that he thinks are impacted by turmeric itself. It appears to have potential not only preventing, as I mentioned, for colon cancer, but perhaps pancreatic cancer as well. And one of our former oncology fellows here, when she was still working at MD Anderson, did a study in 21 patients with pancreatic cancer where she gave them 8.6 grams of turmeric a day, which is a lot of turmeric in capsules. Two of those had maybe some response of their pancreatic cancer. It appears to be safe when used with the main drug that we use in pancreatic cancer, but in this study, only less than 10% of patients had any response. It also appears to boost the activity of some of our standard chemotherapy drugs that we use in many different cancers, but in this study, for lung cancer. One of the reasons that turmeric seems to be useful in colorectal cancer is because it doesn't get absorbed too well into the bloodstream. So it stays in the gastrointestinal tract, and that might be how it's doing its work. But if you give 8.6 grams, or if you take it in conjunction with piperine, the active ingredient in black pepper, you get much more absorption systemically. So some of our colleagues have written a nice book about herb, nutrient, and drug interactions, and says that turmeric can, in fact, interact with some of our standard chemotherapeutic agents, maybe to decrease the toxicity. But in decreasing toxicity, it may be because it's lowering the dose and also lowering the effectiveness. So that's something you have to always be concerned about. Now, I'll give you a little personal turmeric anecdote. I do yoga and have a little osteoarthritis and develop really bad pain, swelling, heat, and inflammation of two joints in my hand that I can't take aspirin. It makes me bleed. And when I take non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, I get all sorts of weird spots. So I went to my friend who wrote the book Integrative Rheumatology in the Weill series of integrative medicine textbooks. And I said, what should I take? And he told me to take a particular curcumin complex. Curcumin is the active ingredient in turmeric that also is combined with black pepper. Now, I have a friend who's a naturopath, and she said she's concerned about black pepper because she thinks it works by irritating the stomach lining, and you absorb also a thousandfold more of anything else that's in the stomach. It really works by blocking destruction of some drugs through a liver pathway. And so I found out the hard way. I only take two prescription medicines, one in the morning and one at night, both for my prostate. And the one you take at night, you take because it lowers your blood pressure. And when I got my curcumin complex with black pepper, you have to take it twice a day. And so I was taking it at night at the same time that I took my prostate medicine. And that first week, my swelling, heat, inflammation, and pain disappeared in 3 days. But every night I woke up with a headache. And I said, oh, great, I have a brain tumor. Because, you know, as an oncologist, it's cancer until proven otherwise. And then I thought about it, and I realized, and this was confirmed because I went to a conference at the NIH, and the guy said, yep, black pepper blocks the metabolism of your alpha blocker. So I was having a higher level of my blood pressure lowering drug, and I was waking up with very low blood pressure and hence a headache. So Something as simply and something that sounds so benign as black pepper can have significant interaction with pharmaceutical agents, and I wanted to point that out. So beef. Now we come to what I said that before that might have startled some people. Recommendation number 5, limit consumption of red meats, beef, pork, and lamb. Whew, that's a big word. Avoid, it's really a big word. Processed meats, bacon, ham, sausage, hot dogs, salami, bologna. This is an old curve showing per capita daily meat consumption in grams and the risk of colorectal cancer in women in various countries. Now I understand the Czech Republic and Japan are out here because they have increased their beef or red meat consumption to the point where they now have the highest rates of colorectal cancer. Now, how can this animal be bad for us, right? This is how that animal is raised for us to consume. What color is missing?
Green.
And what is this white powder? I don't know, but it's in your dairy and your beef. So, unfortunately, what we've done in raising animals nowadays is make them so that they make fat that for us is not good. Omega-6 fatty acids promote inflammation and cause our platelets to clump. Yeah, so that sounds bad, but if you cut yourself, what do you want? You want your platelets to clump so you stop bleeding, and you want heat, red, tender, and swelling so you can heal. So omega-6 is not the enemy, but we have gone totally out of whack in our ratio of omega-6 to omega-3 fatty acids. Omega-3 fatty acids are anti-inflammatory and bust clots. So again, David Servan Shriver, may he rest in peace, was French, so that's why he spells pork differently, but he's showing us the change in the ratio of omega-6 to omega-3 fatty acids in our food chain from 1960 to the year 2000. And I always like to pick on eggs. An egg in the year 1960 had twice as much omega-6 to omega-3. An egg in the year 2000 has 20 times as much omega-6 to omega-3. I only eat one egg a year when we dip it in salt water. That's it. They don't agree with me. But I caution my patients that eggs and poultry are very pro-inflammatory unless you get organic poultry and organic omega-3 eggs. So what do we know? Does it really make a difference? So here's an interesting study that was done at UCLA where they took 48 men who were going to have their prostates removed. And they randomized them to two different diets. One group got only 15% of their calories from fat, and they took 5 grams of fish oil as a supplement, which is a lot of fish oil. That gave them an omega-6 to omega-3 ratio of 2-1. The control Western diet had 40% of their calories from fat and had a 6-3 ratio of 15-1. And they were brought food cooked by UCLA chefs, according to which group they were in, for 4 to 6 weeks before they had their prostates removed. Now, unfortunately, the investigators, I guess they were trying to make a small study, chose the level of serum insulin-like growth factor 1 as the endpoint of the study. That is, they were going to look for a difference between the groups in that particular measurement. And what they found was that there was no effect on serum insulin-like growth factor 1. But what they did find was that the group that had low fat and high omega-3s had lower omega-6 to omega-3 ratios in both their blood and their prostate, and they had smaller prostates, both the normal part and the malignant part. And their Ki-67 index, which is a marker of proliferation of the cancer cells, was lower in the group getting the experimental diet. And then when they took blood from the men in the low-fat, high omega-3 group and put it in the test tube with prostate cancer cells, it inhibited cell proliferation more than the blood from the men in the control group. I think they just chose the wrong endpoint there. That all, to me, sounds very encouraging. But it's not just the omega-6 and the omega-3. It's also the iron in the meat and nitrates from processed meat associated with colorectal cancer. And the worst news yet for July 4th celebrants is that it's barbecuing meat that's bad, because charred meat and well-done meat produces heterocyclic amines, which are very positively associated with the development of colon cancer, although not rectal cancer. So that's just in absence of the hormones and antibiotics and other things that commercially raised cattle are given. And cattle are given bovine growth hormone, and when we get bovine growth hormone, we make insulin-like growth factor, which I've mentioned already numerous times tonight. It's not our friend. I'll have a half-pound double deluxe bacon steer burger, please. You want chemotherapy with that? So, if consumed at all, limit consumption of alcoholic drinks to 2 a day for men and 1 a day for women. I know it sounds sexist, but that's the way it is, because we just metabolize alcohol differently. And this sort of shows relative risk for developing estrogen receptor positive breast cancer in women based on number of drinks a day. Less than one is 7% more than women who don't drink at all. 1 to 2 is 32%, and greater than 3, increased risk 50%. So pretty impressive. So I was happy that the American Society of Clinical Oncology, which is the conventional organ of oncologists, I think the date here is January 2013, improving outcomes, discussing healthy lifestyle choices with your patients. So those of us in the integrative oncology could be considered to be ahead of the curve, but now oncologists are being asked to consider discussing healthy lifestyle. So many of my patients are just blown away to have a physician, an oncologist, talk to them about nutrition. Most of the time they say, they ask their oncologist what they should eat, and they say, it doesn't matter. Or they tell them, when you're getting chemo, eat a lot of ice cream and hamburgers because you need those calories. It's not true. The eighth or seventh guideline, I think it's eighth, says don't use supplements to protect against cancer. And the number of patients I see coming in with shopping bags full of supplements, well, these patients all have cancer, but they're trying to protect against a recurrence, is pretty enormous. So I already quoted Paracelsus, but here he is again. There is poison in everything. It's the difference between a remedy and a poison is the dose. Sort of a paraphrase of the way he said it back then. So let me just show you some of the evidence for that. So I used to smoke cigarettes, and I won't take a multivitamin because most multivitamins contain beta carotene or vitamin A. And an old study that was called the Carrot Study that was done back, I think it was in the 80s actually, looked at smokers and randomized them to vitamin A or beta carotene, vitamin E, both, or neither. And the beta-carotene vitamin A arm actually demonstrated increased lung cancer compared to the group that got nothing. So one reason I don't take a multivitamin, but they noticed that the vitamin E group seemed to have a lower rate of prostate cancer. So to follow up on that, the SELECT study was launched with 35,000 men over the age of 50, enrolled 2001 to 2003, randomly assigned to get either two placebo pills, selenium and placebo, vitamin E and placebo, or active selenium and vitamin E. Study after about 7 years of running, the Data Safety Monitoring Committee said people should stop taking their assigned treatment. It was blinded, so they didn't know. Because first of all, they said there was not going to be any way that the study was going to demonstrate a 25% reduction in the risk of prostate cancer between any of these arms. And what they saw was an increased risk of prostate cancer in the men taking vitamin E. as opposed to the decreased risk, which they thought they were going to find. And also there was an increased risk of diabetes, interestingly, in the men that were randomized to the selenium. So that's when the study was asked to stop. And then JAMA, the Journal of the American Medical Association, published a few years after follow-up on this group and found 521 additional cases of prostate cancer. And the Data Safety Monitoring Board recommended that the study report this to the general public. 592 in the placebo group developed prostate cancer compared to 620, about 100 more, in the group getting vitamin E alone. In the group on selenium, there was an increase, but it was not statistically significant. Similarly, selenium plus vitamin E was also not statistically significant. But the recommendation or the conclusion was vitamin E supplementation significantly increased the risk of prostate cancer in healthy men. I used to take vitamin E as well, but I stopped long before this study was reported because there's no study that's really demonstrated any additional benefit to supplementing with vitamin E. And one of the big problems with this study and all the studies is that vitamin E in nature lives in eight different forms: alpha, beta, gamma, and delta tocopherol, and alpha, beta, gamma, and delta tocotrienol. In these clinical trials and in your multivitamin or in your vitamin E supplement, you're just getting D-alpha tocopherol, unless you buy a vitamin E that contains all the eight isoforms. So if your body gets 400 times the amount that you need a day of alpha tocopherol from your supplement, it's not going to absorb the gamma tocopherol from your walnuts or pistachios. And it may be the gamma tocopherol that's what we need. So that might be why this study demonstrated an increased risk, because you're not absorbing your other isoforms of vitamin E. For vitamin E, I take every once in a while, when I remember, a spoonful of wheat germ oil. Wheat germ oil is a natural source of all the different isoforms, and it doesn't give you a huge toxic amount of that. What about the B vitamins? Gee, B vitamins make you feel good. If you get too much, you just pee it out. It's what makes your urine that fluorescent yellow-orange color if you're taking a B vitamin supplement. We supplement baked goods in our country with B vitamins so that babies are not born with neural tube defects. They don't do that in Norway. So they did a study in Norway to see if B vitamins are useful in older people with heart disease. And they took folic acid, vitamin B12, and vitamin B6, gave it to 1,700 patients, folic acid and B12 to 1,700, B6 alone to 1,700, or placebo to 1,700. And they followed them for just over 3 years. And what do you think they found? The risk of cancer was increased in those patients taking folic acid and B12. Cancer mortality was increased, and all-cause mortality was increased in those patients taking folic acid and B12. In all honesty, I think it's the folic acid, not the B12, that's the culprit here. But Larry Cushy, who's the author of the American Cancer Society guidelines, says there is strong evidence that a diet rich in vegetables, fruits, and other plant-based foods may reduce the risk of cancer. But there's no evidence at this time that supplements can reduce cancer risk, and some evidence exists that indicates that high-dose supplements can increase cancer risk. So, which brings me to vitamin D. Vitamin D is our vitamin of the 21st century. It's now estimated that 1 billion people worldwide are actually vitamin D deficient. Vitamin D is the one that comes from the sunshine. And dark skin, obesity, and heredity may hinder production of vitamin D from sunshine. Older adults, I used to say senior citizens, but a friend of mine who's my age says, "What do you mean by senior citizens?" And I said, "Anybody over 50." She said, "Well, I don't like senior citizens." So anyway, older adults, we don't make it from our skin and our kidneys the way younger do. Now, interestingly, the Institute of Medicine changed the level for what's considered insufficient, because so many Americans were insufficient, they moved the curve so that they now say under 20 is insufficient. I think that's not fair. I think under 30 is insufficient. 45 is adequate. And I don't know if over 80 is optimal. That might be too much. We think about vitamin D deficiency. We all learned in elementary school, rickets. Nobody's ever seen a case. Nobody's really, you know. But anyway, we think of bone health because it's involved in calcium metabolism, and that may be why it's related to back pain. But low levels of vitamin D seem to increase the risk of a number of different cancers. Breast, prostate, colon, some of the big ones, and pancreas all seem to be increased in risk in people with low vitamin D levels. Cancer cells that are exposed to the main active ingredient or the final vitamin D metabolite actually undergo differentiation, cell cycle arrest, and programmed cell death. So that's good news. Vitamin D may also be important in angiogenesis, with high doses of vitamin D inhibiting tumor growth by disrupting new blood vessel formation. And again, the active component seems to potentiate the anti-tumor activity of a number of different chemotherapeutic agents. So vitamin D is good for us. You know, I feel sometimes a little schizoid that I just told you I've eradicated all of my vitamin supplements, but I do. How many people take a vitamin D3 supplement?
Yeah.
And your vitamin D3 should be a gel bead or a liquid, because D is a fat-soluble vitamin. So many people are taking D with calcium as a white powder. You don't absorb it as well if it's a white powder. It should be a gel bead. So there actually is a study going on looking at vitamin D and omega-3 fatty acids, similar to the selenium and vitamin E, to see what it does to older adults. But we don't have the results of that yet. And, you know, hopefully it's not going to show adverse effects. This is a study done in Europe, the European Prospective Investigation into Cancer and Nutrition. They looked at 52,000 adults. They had 1,250 cases of colorectal cancer compared to controls. They found a strong inverse association between pre-diagnosis vitamin D levels and the risk of colorectal cancer. So those people with very low levels had high risk, and those people with good levels had lower risk of colorectal cancer. What they don't know is if it's consumption of dietary vitamin D or if it's a genetic thing, because all of our vitamin D receptors are a little different. So is it taking the supplement? Is it eating a lot of deep cold water fish or, heaven forbid, drinking vitamin D fortified dairy products? We don't know. It might all turn out to be genetics, really, that drive this train. In a retrospective study of baseline vitamin D levels in newly diagnosed patients with metastatic colorectal cancer at Memorial Sloan Kettering, they found the median vitamin D levels of these patients was quite low. Only 7 patients had levels over 40. 83% were deficient. And those patients with low vitamin D had survival outcomes 1.5 times worse than those with normal levels. Again, it's unknown whether aggressive vitamin D replacement improves the outcomes or if these are just predicting people that are going to do better by virtue of some genetic issue. So, one question I get a lot is, can I take this? And here I am at the Osher Center with my cup of green tea, and a patient brought me just a few supplements for me to look at. And what's the answer to the question, can I take this? Evidence-based. Evidence-based, I don't know. But nobody's going to come sit there with me for an hour to hear me say, I don't know, I don't know, I don't know. So I have to use evidence-informed, you know. Can I take this? So I look very carefully at the ingredients and see what it is. So I mentioned that pathway in the liver that got me a little with my black pepper and my uroxetrol. But the same thing, this liver pathway is involved with metabolizing many anti-cancer drugs. And some agents induce this pathway, meaning it cranks it up. So if you take St. John's wort while you're taking chemotherapy, you're going to increase the activity of this enzyme that breaks down prescription drugs, and you're going to get less of the chemotherapy in your bloodstream than your oncologist thinks you're getting. And with less chemo, you might have cells that become resistant, and you might not have as good an effect as you want. So actually, St. John's wort is the most studied complementary intervention, and there's now sort of the recommendation that any patient taking chemotherapy should stay away from St. John's wort, which is used for mild to moderate depression. Have we studied echinacea and camptothecans, echinacea and cyclophosphamide? You can see that to do all these studies would cost a lot of money, plus you're not going to get normal controls to take these chemotherapy drugs and then take these. You're going to have to do this in cancer patients, and cancer patients are not going to want to take garlic or something while they're getting their chemo. You know, so evidence-informed is all we can do. Interestingly, ginkgo, on the other hand, inhibits this enzyme. So if you take ginkgo while you're getting this chemotherapy, you're going to get increased level of these drugs, which is going to increase the toxicity. So it is a problem. The other issue is, as I mentioned earlier with Dr. Watson, this question of antioxidants. So oxygen lives as two molecules linked together. O2, right? That's what we breathe, that's how we live. But when those oxygen molecules separate, they create reactive oxygen species or free radicals, which knock into our DNA, causing damage, which leads to aging or cancer. Antioxidants take those free radicals out of circulation so they don't do damage. Radiation therapy damages cancer cells by creating reactive oxygen species to knock into the cancer cell DNA to kill it. So the fear is, if you take antioxidants while you're getting radiation, what happens? You're going to negate the benefit of the radiation therapy. We also have some chemotherapy that works by creating oxidative stress. And those are the chemotherapeutic agents that seem to work mostly via that mechanism. On the other hand, we have antioxidants that our patients want to take. But if they take these antioxidants while they're getting this chemo or those radiations, they may, in fact, be decreasing the benefit of their cancer treatment. So, on the other hand, however, Keith Block, who's the editor of the journal Integrative Cancer Therapies, did a meta-analysis of 19 different randomized control trials, and 17 of 19 showed either a significant advantage or a non-statistically significant increase in survival or treatment response in patients receiving antioxidants. Interestingly, the antioxidants that he reports on are not the ones that my patients mostly take. They were glutathione or N-acetylcysteine, which, again, are not vitamin A, C, and E, et cetera. So what is my approach? When patients come to see me and ask, can I take this if it's an antioxidant, I say, if our goal is to cure, or if we're giving chemotherapy in an adjuvant setting, that is, for example, breast cancer has been removed and there's no cancer in the body, but we're giving chemo to wipe out any microscopic cells that might be there, you know, why go through it and possibly negate the benefit of the chemo? So if we're going to go for cure, or if we're using adjuvant chemotherapy, let's delay antioxidants until the end of treatment. A number of my colleagues at the Cancer Center have told their patients, stop your antioxidants the day before, the day of, and the day after chemotherapy. Well, that's fine, but it doesn't take into account the half-life of the chemo or the antioxidant. So I say no. But I do say antioxidant-rich foods are okay regardless of what you're doing. Many patients come and say, oh no, my radiation therapist said, while I'm getting radiation, I can only eat white foods, totally devoid of any nutritional value. No, it's okay to eat antioxidants. If it comes down to a fight between that blueberry and that beam of radiation, who do you think wins? So I think it's okay. If our goal is palliation, if we can't cure the patient, maybe if they feel they want to empower themselves by taking an antioxidant, it's probably okay. It's interesting that we, as oncologists, prescribe very expensive intravenous antioxidants to protect patients from some of the side effects of chemotherapeutic agents and don't really worry about whether they interfere with the effects of our conventional therapy. So let me talk for a moment about stress, because I mentioned that early on. And there's a problem with this quote, although it's very lovely. With all that we know about how stress aggravates cardiovascular disease, promotes viral infection, exacerbates metabolic diseases, halts reproduction, and regulates the normal function of virtually every cell in the body, why would cancer cells somehow be exempt? Well, because they're not regulated. That's why they're cancer cells. So sort of surprising that somebody said this at the National Cancer Institute, but the gist of it is, you know, stress impacts on everything. So again, as I mentioned earlier, I don't believe that there's much evidence that stress directly causes cancer. It's neither necessary nor sufficient to initiate carcinogenesis. But as I mentioned, stress hormones can accelerate the growth of established tumors. And I also mentioned that beta blockers, which block catecholamines, seem to be now very popular in the investigation as adjunctive therapies for patients with cancer. Now, here's an interesting study where women with ovarian cancer were interviewed prior to their surgery. Women who lacked social support networks and had higher levels of distress, their tumors were found to have higher levels of vascular endothelial growth factor associated with increased blood vessel formation. And they say this is the first association between a psychological factor and a cytokine involved in tumor angiogenesis. And they later reported that those women actually had poorer outcomes. And this was also duplicated in 37 patients with head and neck cancer who had squamous cell carcinomas. Higher levels of perceived stress and depressive symptoms were significantly associated with greater VEGF expression. Intense VEGF expression had a median performance-free survival 47% higher than patients with weak expression. Associations were strongest for early-stage patients. High VEGF was more than 2.5 times more likely to die. So stress, distress, depression related to worse outcomes. So what do we do? So we recommend that people do some of those mind-body interventions. Support groups are not based on breathing like most of the others, nor journalism, but journaling, writing down how you feel, telling other people that you have cancer, guided imagery, hypnosis, breath work, or psychotherapy are all ways to decrease stress. And we do have a little data here from the National Cancer Institute. 200 women scheduled for breast biopsy or lumpectomy were randomly assigned to 15-minute hypnosis session 1 hour before surgery, or they spent 15 minutes with a psychologist talking and receiving emotional support. Everybody was blinded as to which group the patient was in. And at the end of the day, the women in the hypnosis group required less anesthesia, although they had the same post-op meds. They reported less pain intensity, unpleasantness, nausea, fatigue, discomfort, and emotional upset. And most important, they spent 10 and a half minutes less in surgery, saving $770, which is what will get insurance companies to cover the cost of hypnosis. So that's what we need to do, is show the cost effectiveness of some of these interventions. Every patient I see at the Osher Center, most every patient, can't say every, I suggest that they be seen by one of my traditional Chinese medicine colleagues. Traditional Chinese medicine is all about expelling evil and supporting good. Modern Western medicine focuses on expelling evil. Coming to see me, I tend to support good. But when you go to a traditional Chinese medicine practitioner, they do both at the same time, but from a different angle. So they won't say you have metastatic breast cancer. They'll say you have decreased spleen qi and increased kidney yang, and they'll treat that. And I think for many of my patients, using all the tools available in the toolbox is important. The National Institutes of Health had a consensus conference in 1997, which said that acupuncture was useful as an anti-emetic or anti-nausea drug for patients receiving chemotherapy. I also think it's useful for controlling pain, particularly peripheral neuropathy or damage to nerves, which many of our patients get from their chemo. Anxiety, depression, There's now some clinical trials that show that patients who get acupuncture while they're getting radiation to their head and neck get less problems with dry mouth afterwards. There's also clinical trials which have demonstrated that hot flashes secondary to hormonal therapy, both in men and women who have had hormonal manipulations for breast or prostate cancer, are also ameliorated by acupuncture. I think it's also useful for energy, sleep, possibly immune enhancement, and also keeping the blood cell count up. Many women with postmenopausal breast cancer are treated with aromatase inhibitors. About 20% stop the drugs because of musculoskeletal side effects, joint pain, muscle aches. And in a clinical trial which randomized patients to true acupuncture or sham acupuncture, and we could spend another hour talking about whether there is such a thing as sham or placebo acupuncture, here they used superficial needle insertion at locations not recognized as true acupuncture points. At the end of the day, they found pain reduced 50% in the patients getting true acupuncture from baseline, but no change in the group getting sham acupuncture. It's also been demonstrated to be as effective as the current standard in treatment of hot flashes in women, effective in hot flashes in men undergoing androgen deprivation therapy for prostate cancer. Also, one of the things that we get concerned about is whether or not it's safe to put needles in people with low white blood cell counts. Will that cause infection? Or low platelet counts, thrombocytopenia, will they bleed? And in a study at Columbia, the group there found that it was indeed safe for patients, children with cancer who had low platelet counts to be treated with acupuncture needles without increased risk of bleeding. So again, what I do is, this is the Mount Zion Cancer Center at 1600 Divisadero. The Osher Center used to be over here at 1701. But a year and a half ago, we moved to our new building at 1545 Divisadero. The Osher Center, the third floor is our research wing, fourth floor is our clinic, and fifth floor is education, administration, and our two yoga rooms. And so I like to say that I'm bridging the gap between the Cancer Center and the Osher Center by providing integrative medicine consultation to people living with and beyond cancer. And I think, you know, it's important for us to remember what it is, the goal of being a physician, and that is to cure sometimes, heal often, and support always. And with that, I'll thank you for your attention, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.